This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had to be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hi, this is Gary Clinton. And we're about to embark on another adventure in audio, mostly old radio. And we're going to start with an episode from the series Quiet Please. Quiet Please ran from 1947 through 1949, first on the Mutual Network and then on ABC. Behind the series Quiet Please, Wallace Cooper. You may or may not know that name. If you do know the name, it's probably as the creator of the horror series Lights Out, which he created in 1934, left in, I think, about 1937. Lights Out was then taken over by Arch Obler, whose name is even more familiar than Willis Cooper. There are many similarities between these two shows. You know, and each listener is invited to shut off all the outside stimuli, turn down the lights, get real quiet and concentrate on the story. That's still good advice, which is called Whence Came You? It concerns a man who meets a mysterious woman in the mid-1930s in Cairo, Egypt. It's got it all, really. Like I said, there's a weird woman. There's an ancient tomb. There's a curse. Oh, and there's an ancient god. It's well acted, well written, well played. It really doesn't get much better than this. It first appeared on February the 16th of 1948.
The Mutual Broadcasting System presents Quiet, Please, which is written and directed by Willis Cooper and which features Ernest Chappell. Quiet, Please, for tonight is called Whence Came You?
I came from Jerusalem. I've traveled in the East a good deal in the last 20-odd years, and I flatter myself that I know my way around. So when I got off the plane at Cairo, I didn't start for the camp right away as a good storybook archaeologist would have done. I made a beeline for Shepherd's in the room I'd left a couple of days before when I went to Jerusalem. A bath, a gin and tonic, and a large batch of mail from the States. What more can a man ask? In Cairo on a hot night? But of course it was too good to last. Just gonna let him knock. Go away.
Hey, Austin, wake up!
Now, who the...
Hey, it's Abe Feldman!
Abe Feldman?
Hi, Austin. We got from Satan Valley.
Well, I'll be darned. Come on in. What are you doing here? What do you got there?
I do get around, don't I? This is gin and tonic. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, but come in. Well, sit down. You're the last man in the world that I...
Here, take a gin and tonic before I drop it. Well,
Look, I'm in spades, eh? By golly, I'm glad to see you, boy.
I'm glad to see you. I've been looking here for 3 days, waiting for you to come back. Hey, you look skinnier.
Well, you go out and dig holes out there for 6 months, lad. You'll take off some of that fat, too.
Me fat? Go away, you're kidding. Well, get your shirt on and let's go see the town.
Sit down. Come on, what you doing here?
Business?
Yeah, what kind of business?
Newspaper business, Natch. What's cooking in the Middle East and stuff? Say, how do you get more of these things?
We'll get on the bar in a minute. They're colder down there. Well, go on. Tell me about it.
Well, you know, Eddie Heffercamp just called me in and said draw some dough and go east and send up some stuff for the Sunday feature section. The trip's making a monkey out of us again. So I remember the dear old days on the Midway, you and me, and you're around here, so let's go see the town, huh?
Well, I'll be darned. When did you leave Chicago?
Day before yesterday.
Oh, boy.
Yep. The loop's still there. They still got the Burlicue shows on South State Street. The Michigan Avenue Bridge is always up. The Cubs are in seventh place. Now?
Now what?
Now we go see the town? Come on, put on your pants.
You've never been in Cairo before, have you?
Me? Not me. Why?
Well, if you had, you wouldn't care much about seeing it, my boy.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But, women.
You had a good look at any of them?
Have I? Oh, boy.
What?
The one that's waiting for you downstairs.
Waiting for me?
Wow.
What are you talking about? I don't know any women in Cairo.
Well, there's one who knows you.
Why, you're crazy.
I'm telling you.
How do you know?
She's been waiting down there for 3 days. I've seen her.
What'd she look like?
Oh, boy.
Not a native.
Cleopatra.
Is this one of your bum jokes, Abe?
I give you my word of honor.
I don't get it.
Come on downstairs and you will.
So we went downstairs. British colonels, American traveling salesmen, Egyptian army officers. A fee for two, a bevy of the ugliest women in the world. And I don't see any woman waiting for me.
There. By the door to the bar.
And I looked. And there by the door stood the one most beautiful woman I have ever seen in all my life. She was no Egyptian native. She might have descended from one of the marvelously lifelike paintings of a queen of the Hathor dynasty that I'd seen on the walls of tombs 2,000 years old. How can I describe her? I see her eyes were black. Her hair was black and cut in the manner of the days of the shepherd kings that ruled the valley of the Nile 1,000 years before the pyramids were built. Red lips that smiled at me slowly. I felt my knees tremble as she looked into my eyes.
Come on, let's go ask her. She's got a friend.
And when I looked back at her, where'd she go? Midnight, and then 1 o'clock, and two, and then three. We still walked the streets of Cairo. The waning moon was rising in the northeast behind our shoulders as we turned our steps back to the hotel. Twice I thought I'd seen her, and twice she, if she it was, disappeared into a narrow winding street where we couldn't follow. No, I never followed women about the streets of a foreign city before, not in all my life. Well, there's little enough of that in the life of an archaeologist. The women we followed died 1,000, 10,000 years before we were born. We know them only by the portraits painted on the walls of a musty tomb. By what we find in great hermetically sealed stone caskets, wrapped in rust-colored linen and smelling of the ghost of cinnamon and myrrh and spikenard. I don't know why I did this.
I know. She wanted you to come after her.
Well, that's ridiculous, Abe.
I heard her ask for you.
Well, what would she want of me?
What does a pretty gal usually want of a guy? Drinks, something to eat, a good time?
She could have had that from anybody.
Yeah, me, for instance. But she wanted you, Austin.
Well, why?
Maybe she's a spy or something.
A spy?
Maybe she wanted to sell you something. You know, you grave robbers. Maybe she knows where some old pharaoh or somebody is planted.
Yeah, that could be, I suppose. Well, I'm for bed. I got to get out to the diggings early.
Fine night we had.
Forget it. You got a room, huh?
Yeah, right down the hall. Well, knock on my door when you get up.
All right. Good night.
Night. Say, they have this incense all the time around this place, huh?
What do you mean?
Don't you smell it? Smells like a funeral.
I don't. Oh. Yeah, I suppose. Night.
Night, Austin.
I could have told him what the incense was. I've smelled cinnamon and myrrh and spikenard too often not to recognize it instantly. When I opened the door to my room, the smell was almost overpowering, used as I am to the funeral spices of ancient Egyptian tombs. No, I'm not going to tell you that a beautiful Egyptian princess of the days of Hyksos was waiting for me in the darkness. This isn't a ghost story. There wasn't anyone in the room. I came up and the thunder crashed. And I was scared to death. Then I woke up and the thunder was the servant knocking on my door, bringing me my morning cup of tea. Abe and I got in my Jeep and rode out to the excavation. It's quite a distance from Cairo. But never mind just where it is, because that's my business. And the university's. That right rear tire went flat, just as I'd been expecting. I forgot to put air in the spare, so we took quite a while getting it pumped up. It was late in the afternoon when we got there. Abe had never seen anything of this sort. You see, Abe, these places are built one on top of another. Almost every village and town in the east is.
Different periods of time, huh?
Yeah, that's right. There may be any number of cities built above the ruins of another. All we do is dig out the top one, you see, recover everything we can that's of historical importance, then go on carefully down to the next.
What do you do with the stuff that's on top?
It has to be destroyed, naturally.
Well, gee, that's too bad, ain't it?
Well, we make careful records, photographs.
And then you just peel off the stuff and go on to the next.
That's right. This is the fourth city from the top we're working on now. See those big, that big pile of rubble over there?
Yeah.
That's the remains of the other three cities.
Gee, that seems a shame. All those years of work and living and everything.
Well, we save artifacts, of course.
Save what?
Things that people made. Potsherds, fragments of wall painting, decorations, that sort of thing.
What do you do with the people you find?
People?
Yeah.
Oh, mummies. Various things. We read the inscriptions. Decide whether the fellow is important enough to investigate further. The Egyptian government has a great deal to say about the contents of tombs, you know.
Find any gold?
Not here so far, but we probably will. This part where we're standing was the necropolis of this particular city.
Huh?
The cemetery, see?
Oh, yeah.
It's reasonable to suppose that there are other tombs under here.
That's where you find the jewels and the gold and stuff?
Generally, yes.
Say, Austin, why don't you get a steam shovel in here? You'd move this stuff a lot quicker.
And probably smash some priceless inscriptions or paintings into bits. No, my boy, we do this gently.
Uh-huh. And you can read this stuff, huh? The hieroglyphics?
Hieroglyphics comes from two Greek words originally meaning carving by priests.
Okay, Professor. Can you read it?
Yeah, of course. I can read a good deal of the later writings by sight. When we get down to the real ancient stuff, that's a little more difficult.
What does this say?
What?
This slab here.
Now, let's see. Here was I, Hotep, presented with a... Well, I guess you'd say invested with the working tools of those who build. In my hand, I, Hotep, did... took the tools of the second grade of workmen in stone, the plumb, the square, and the...
The level, huh?
How'd you know?
There were masons in those days.
Well, sure. How do you think they built all this stone stuff?
Hey, look at that. What's that there?
It's a name...
Hey, look at that. What's that there?
It's a name. Sholem. It's probably Solomon. Yeah, this was in Solomon's time.
Right alongside the name.
The middle stone of an arch, which is secret.
The keystone. These fellas didn't know how to build an arch.
Well, that's right, they didn't. Why are you so excited about it, though?
Hey!
What?
Look at that.
This? Yeah, that's a very fine example of wall painting. Look how the colors are still bright. Look how they...
Yeah. You see the same thing I see, don't you?
You know what I saw. You know whose portrait was painted on the edge of the slab that came from a tomb that was old in the time of Augustus Caesar? Coincidence or not, here was the face of the woman who waited for me the night before in Shepherd's Hotel. It's a amazing how racial characteristics persist through centuries in Egypt. I have seen Egyptian men who might have been Tutankhamun's own brother. I've seen women, but you wouldn't blame me for feeling my hackles rise a little at this uncanny resemblance to the woman who disappeared. I kept smelling myrrh and spikenard and cinnamon. But I hadn't much time to think of it then. Martin Weaver, who was in charge of the actual excavation, came up behind us.
Well, glad you're back, Orson.
Oh, hello, Martin. How are we doing? Dave Belden, Martin Weaver.
How are you?
Hello. Well, day before yesterday, we broke through a place, Orson, that goes down to the city underneath this one.
You did?
Yeah, one of the workmen found a big sandstone slab, and we cleared it away completely. I've got the big shears rigged over it now, and I thought we'd wait till you got here to lift the slab. You want to do it tonight or what?
Oh, gosh, let's do it now, Austin.
Well, what do you think? Getting dark.
Let's have a look at it.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're back. Bring anything to drink with you?
We walked half a mile. There was a little clearing at one corner of the necropolis, and the beams of the shears stood stark against the darkening sky. There was something elemental, something deathly about them. Not an archaeologist's job to be sentimental or superstitious. None of us would stay on the job very long if we were. But the half-inch steel cable was attached to a block of stone that was the only thing that separated us from something that happened perhaps 40 centuries ago. And, well, there are times when a man's entitled to shiver a little in the wind that rises over the desert at sunset. Abe was beside himself with excitement.
Let's pull it up, Austin. Go on, let's pull it up, huh?
Go ahead, Martin.
Okay. Glad we got the engine. That slab weighs about 70 tons.
Go ahead. A little higher.
Gosh. The air down there.
That air you're breathing, Abe, was breathed by pharaohs long before Moses led his people out of this country.
Gee.
Okay, hold it, Martin.
Right.
You going down there, Austin?
Tomorrow.
Oh, not now?
No, no, it's late.
Oh, gee, I'd like to go down there.
We will in the morning.
How is it?
Let's take your flashlight.
Yeah.
Yeah, mummy case, some wall paintings.
Let me see.
Take the flashlight.
Boy, oh, boy. It isn't far down there. I'm going to jump down.
No, no, wait.
Don't do that. I'll be all right.
Now, don't go running all over that place, tracking it up, Abe.
I won't, boy. It's dark down here.
Get a ladder, Martin.
Yeah, okay.
You hear me, Abe?
I hear you. Throw me your flashlight.
Doggone it. That's the last time you... Here. Now, stand still.
I'm standing still. Hey, Austin.
What?
There's a picture on the wall.
What picture?
Over here on the wall, Curtis. I dropped the light.
Well, stand still. Martin will be back in a minute with his light.
Austin.
What?
There's something in here.
Well, be careful. It might be a snake.
No, it ain't a snake.
Abe. Abe, what happened?
Look out, Austin! Look out, the slab!
We worked all night long, Martin and I, splicing that steel cable and raising the heavy slab that had imprisoned Abe in that place of the dead. We had no hope, but what could we do? A miracle might have happened. There might have been a chink between the slab and the opening it covered, an opening through which a few breaths of air might have seeped into the tomb. The snake might not have bitten him. He might have killed it. So we told each other all through the night. The stubborn cable cut our hands and defied our every effort. The sun was just rising when we at last had made it fast, and Martin started the engine. We fastened the rope onto the cable, and we swung the great stone slab aside. I was down in the tomb almost before it had cleared the opening. I nearly sickened as I called to Martin. He jumped down, too.
Oh, my good... What happened to him?
I thought it was a snake.
No snake did that.
No.
I saw a pigeon once that a hawk had been at.
We'd have been too late even if the slab hadn't fallen.
Well. Lawson.
What?
That mummy case. Was the cover off it last night when you looked down here?
No. Why, Abe couldn't have.
That lid weighs 10 tons.
Then we looked down into the stone coffin. I hope I shall never see the like of that again.
What is it?
The mummy of a man. A tall man. In a robe of gold cloth. Not wrapped in linen bindings, just a robe of gold cloth with strange symbols woven into the cloth. And his head. Not a man's head. The head of a hawk. No, not a mask. We look carefully. A man with a head of a hawk. And the hawk's beak. All dabbled with red. I didn't believe it either. It couldn't be. But it was. It was the father of all the Egyptian gods, Osiris. Osiris, the brother husband of Isis, the founder of the world's first empire. Osiris, who was murdered 16,000 years ago. And his body was hidden by Isis, his wife, with a blasting curse on any who might find his tomb. It was impossible. It couldn't be. But there it was. And Martin and I and the dead man were there in his tomb with him. And the curse hung heavy in the musty air around us. And then the first rays of the sun reflected from something above us stole down into the tomb. And I saw the pictures on the wall. I saw Osiris with his hawk's head. And the robe he wore and the mitre on his hawk's head was the same that the mummy wore in casket. I saw Isis, his wife, weeping over the body of her murdered husband. And the beauty of the work of the long-dead artist was unbelievable. And I saw another picture. There was the daughter of Isis and Osiris. Yes. Yes, of course I could read the inscriptions. Yes. Of course I could recognize her face. I'd seen it before. In the lobby of Shepherd's Hotel. And the inscriptions on the wall were terrifying. There were secrets there that men would give their lives to possess today. There were secrets there that we've only begun to imagine today. I'm a scientist, I know. Or do I? We forgot the thing in the coffin. We forgot the thing on the floor. And it grew darker and darker in the tomb. And I read on and on. I stood before the painting of the one who was Osiris' daughter. Long black hair. Red lips that smiled at me. And my heart stopped at the inscription under the portrait. I read it over again. Be not afraid. Ah. Living rock in the ancient Heratic characters uncounted centuries ago. Not by the hand of the artist. I knew who had carved my name there. Be not afraid, Austin. And I wasn't afraid at all when I discovered that the thing that was making a dot down there was a great slab of sandstone. Slowly swinging around and down to imprison us all in the tomb that the wife of Osiris had cursed. Martin Weaver was a very brave man. Martin Weaver didn't scream and cry in the heavy dark. Martin Weaver talked to me quietly.
It'll be all right, Austin. The workmen will be here before long, and they'll see the slab, and Ibrahim knows how to run the engine.
I hope so, Martin. I hope they'll be in time.
They'll be in time. He'll start the engine and pull the thing off. All right.
I hope so, Martin.
Sure. They'll know that something's wrong.
Where are you?
Right here.
Well, stand still.
I am standing still.
I thought I heard you move.
Oh. You afraid, Austin?
Are you?
Not particularly. But I...
Yes.
And the thing in the... Where are you going?
I haven't moved.
I thought I felt your hand on my arm.
No. Sit still. Don't use up the air.
Well, you sit still.
I tell you, I didn't move.
Something's moving.
It couldn't be.
Austin?
What? Martin? 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 Answer me, Martin! And there was nothing but silence. And then another footstep. And I felt a hand on my arm and I screamed with terror. Solid stone wall. My feet dragged as I followed whoever it was through a door that I knew couldn't be there. And a voice breathed in my ear.
Austin.
And I smelled cinnamon and myrrh and spikenard. And I followed on. And soon there was a glimmering of light ahead of me, and I felt the hand release my arm, and I walked on toward the light. Then, in a little while, another little room hewn out of the solid rock. And a light burning. A little bronze lamp at the head of a mummy case of lacquered painted wood. And the portrait image on the lid of the sarcophagus. The same face. A smile. And I came closer to read the inscription I knew would be there. An inscription put there so many, many years ago. I have freed you, Austin. Now free me. My hand went to the fastening of the lid. When I looked up to the wall above, the portrait again, but with a difference. The same costume, the same jewelry, the same headdress. But the head was the head of a hawk. The head of Osiris' daughter. So I sit here, and the little bronze lamp is flickering low. No. I haven't opened the coffin. I'm afraid to.
Thank you. The next show is a little different. It's called Sleep No More, and it offers dramatic readings of thrillers. Often two or three per show. There is a regular cast, consisting of one person, Nelson Armstead. Nelson Armstead reads the story with a background of spooky music and some pretty good sound effects. The series ran from 1952 to 1956, starting as a 15-minute show, and then moved on to 30 minutes. This particular episode is called The Storm, and it ran on December the 12th of 1956.
Sleep no more. Sleep no more. Turn down the lights. Sink back in your chair and don't look into the shadows. In the shadows, there may be moving things. Tonight, it may be, you will sleep no more. Good evening. This is Ben Grauer introducing tonight's tale of terror, told by Nelson Armstead on the National Broadcasting Company's presentation of Sleep No More. The story of terror can be as simple as a sheeted ghost rattling chains. It can be a complex and hidden world of horror, lurking in such unholy dimensions as only the dead and the moonstruck can glimpse. Or it can be those terrible, fathomless shadows which lie buried deep in the primitive mind of civilized man. And for this evening, well, Nelson Armstead, tell us about this evening's story.
It's called The Storm by McKnight Melmar, who, incidentally, is a woman. It's a story about a woman who comes home one night to a big, empty house to find a pinpoint of light where there should be no light.
It sounds chilling. So let Nelson Armstead tell us about the woman alone at night and the storm.
She inserted her key in the lock and turned the knob. The March wind snatched the door out of her hand and slammed it back against the wall. It took strength to close it against the pressure of the gale. She breathed a sigh of thankfulness at being home again and in time. In rain like this, the crossroads always were flooded. Half an hour later, her cab couldn't have got through the rising water, and there was no alternative route. There was no light anywhere in the house. Ben wasn't home then. As she turned on the lamp by the sofa, she had a sense of anticlimax. All the way home, she had been visiting her sister. She had seen herself going into a lighted house to Ben, who would be sitting by the fire with his paper. She had taken delight in picturing his happy surprise at seeing her home a week earlier than he'd expected her. She had known just how his round face would light up, how his eyes would twinkle behind his glasses, how he would catch her by the shoulders and look down into her face to see the changes a month had made in her, and then kiss her resoundingly on both cheeks like a French general bestowing a decoration. Then she would make coffee and find a piece of cake, and they would sit together by the fire and talk. But Ben wasn't here. She looked at the clock in the mantel and saw it was nearly 10. Well, perhaps he hadn't planned to come home tonight, as he wasn't expecting her. Even before she had left, he frequently was in the city all night because business kept him too late to catch the last train. Well, if he didn't come home soon, he wouldn't be able to make it at all. She began to walk through the house, turning on lights as she went. Ben had left it in fairly good order. There was very little trace of an untidy masculine presence, but then he was a tidy man. She made coffee. The wind hammered at the door and the windows. Listening, she wished for Ben almost feverishly. She never had felt so alone, and he was such a comfort. He had been so good about her going for this long visit, made because her sister was ill. He had seen to everything and had put her on the train with her arms loaded with books and candy and fruit. She knew those farewell gifts had meant a lot to him. He didn't spend money easily. To be quite honest, he was a little close. But he was a good husband. She repeated it to herself firmly as she sipped her coffee. He was a good husband. Suppose he was 10 years older than she and a little set in his ways, a little, perhaps, dictatorial at times and moody. He'd given her what she thought she wanted, security and a home of her own. If security were not enough, she couldn't blame him for it. Her eye caught a shred of white protruding under a magazine on the table beside her. She put out a hand toward it, yet her fingers were almost reluctant to grasp it. She pulled it out nevertheless, and saw that it was, as she had known instinctively, another of the white envelopes. It was empty, and it bore, as usual, the neat typewritten address, Benjamin T. Wilson, Esquire, Wildwood Road, Fairport, Connecticut. The postmark was New York City. It never varied. She felt the familiar constriction about the heart as she held it in her hands. What these envelopes contained, she never had known. What she did know was their effect on Ben. After receiving one, and one came every month or two, he was irritable, at times almost ugly. Their peaceful life together fell apart. At first, she had questioned him, had striven to soothe and comfort him, but she soon had learned that this only made him angry, and of late, she had avoided any mention of them. This one was postmarked 3 days before. If Ben got home tonight, he would probably be cross, and the storm wouldn't help his mood. Just the same, she wished he would come. She tore the envelope into tiny pieces and tossed them into the fireplace. As she straightened, a movement at the window caught her eye. She froze there, not breathing, still half bent toward the cold fireplace, her hand extended. The glimmer of white at the window behind the sheeting blur of rain had been, she was sure of it, a human face. There had been eyes. She was certain there had been eyes staring in at her. The wind's shout took on a personal, threatening note. She was rigid for a long time, never taking her eyes from the window. But nothing moved there now, except the water on the window pane. Beyond it, there was blackness, and that was all. The only sounds were the threshing of the trees, the roar of the water, the ominous howl of the wind. If only Ben would come home. If only she weren't so alone. She shivered and pulled Ben's coat tighter around her and told herself she was becoming a morbid fool. Nevertheless, she found the aloneness intolerable. Her ears strained to hear prowling footsteps outside the windows. She became convinced that she did hear them, slow and heavy. Well, perhaps Ben could be reached at the hotel where he sometimes stayed. She no longer cared whether her homecoming was a surprise to him. She wanted to hear his voice. She went to the telephone and lifted the receiver. No, the line was quite dead. The wires were down, of course. She fought panic. Now, the face at the window had been an illusion, a trick of light. And the sound of footsteps was an illusion, too. Actual ones would be inaudible in the noise made by the wild storm. Nobody would be out tonight. Nothing threatened her, really. The storm was held at bay behind these walls, and in the morning, the sun would shine again. The thing to do was to make herself as comfortable as possible and settle down with a book. There was no use going to bed. She couldn't possibly sleep. She would only lie there wide awake and think of that face at the window, hear those footsteps. She would get some wood and build a fire in the fireplace. She hesitated at the top of the cellar stairs. The light, as she switched it on, seemed insufficient. The concrete wall at the foot of the stairs was dank with moisture and somehow gruesome. And wind was chilling her ankles. Rain was beating in through the outside door to the cellar because that door was standing open. The inner bolt sometimes didn't hold, she knew very well. If it had not been carefully closed, the wind could have loosened it. It took her a long minute to nerve herself to go down the steps and reach out into the darkness for the door latch. The wind helped her and slammed the door resoundingly. She jammed the rusty bolt home with all her strength and then tested it to make sure it would hold. She almost sobbed with relief of knowing it to be firm against any intruder. She had only to get an arm full of wood. Then she could have a fire. She would have light and warmth and comfort. She would forget these terrors. The cellar smelled of dust and old moisture. The beams were fuzzed with cobwebs. There was only the one dim bulb. The wood pile was in the far corner, away from the light. She stopped and peered around. Nothing could hide here. The cellar was too open, the supporting stanchions too slender to hide a man. She almost ran to the wood pile. What was it? Not a noise. Something she had seen as she hurried across the dusty floor. Something odd. She searched with her eyes. Why, it was the spark of light she had seen where no spark should be. Her eyes widened, round and dark as the frightened deer's. Her old trunk that stood against the wall was open, just a crack. And from the crack came this tiny pinpoint of reflected light to prick the cellar's gloom. She went toward it like a woman hypnotized. It was only one more insignificant thing, like the envelope on the table, the vision of the face at the window, the open door. There was no reason for her to feel so smothered in terror. Yet, she was sure she had not only closed the lid of the trunk, but clamped it shut. She was sure because she kept two or three old coats in it, wrapped in newspapers and tightly shut away from moths. But now, the lid was raised perhaps an inch, and the twinkle of light was still there. She threw back the lid. One moment, she stood looking down into the trunk, while each detail of its contents burned itself on her brain. Each tiny detail was indelibly clear and never to be forgotten. She could not have stirred a muscle in that moment. Horror was a black cloak thrown around her, stopping her breath, hobbling her limbs. Then her face dissolved into formlessness, and she slammed down the lid and ran up the stairs like a mad thing. She was breathing again, in deep sobbing breaths that tore at her lungs. She shut the door at the top of the stairs with a crash that shook the house. Then she turned the key. Her old trunk had held the curled up body of a woman. Her first impulse was to get out of the house. But in the time it took her to get to the front door, she remembered the face at the window. Oh, perhaps she hadn't imagined it after all. Perhaps it was the face of a murderer. A murderer waiting for her out there in the storm, ready to spring on her out of the dark and the rain. Oh, she fell into the big chair, her huddled body shaken by great tremors. She couldn't stay here, not with that thing in her trunk. Yet she dared not leave. Her whole being cried out for Ben. He would know what to do. She closed her eyes, opened them again, rubbed them hard. The picture still burned into her brain as if it had been etched with acid. Her hair, loosened, fell in soft, straight wisps around her forehead, and her mouth was slack with terror. She had not seen the face of the woman. The head had been tucked down into the hollow of the shoulder, and a shower of fair hair had fallen over it. The woman had worn a red dress. One hand had rested near the edge of the trunk, and on its third finger, there had been a man's ring. A signet bearing the raised figure of a rampant lion with a small diamond between its paws. It had been the diamond that caught the light. The little bulb in the corner of the cellar had picked out this ring from the semi-darkness and made it stand out like a beacon. She would never be able to forget it. Shudders continued to shake her. She bit her tongue
and pressed her hand against her jaw to stop the chattering of her teeth. She drew the coat closer about her, trying to dispel the mortal cold that held her. Slowly, something beyond the mere fact of murder, of death, began to penetrate her mind. Slowly, she realized that beyond this fact, there would be consequences. That body in the cellar was not an isolated phenomenon. Some train of events had led to its being there and would follow its discovery there. There would be policemen. At first, the thought of policemen was a comforting one. Big, brawny men in blue who would take the thing out of her cellar and take it away so she never need think of it again. Then she realized it was her cellar, hers and Ben's, and policemen are suspicious and prying. Would they think she had killed the woman? Could they be made to believe she never had seen her before? Or would they think Ben had done it? Would they take the letters in the white envelopes and Ben's absences on business and her own visit to her sister, about which Ben had been so helpful, and out of them build a double life for him? Would they insist that the woman had been a discarded mistress who had hounded him with letters until out of desperation he had killed her? Well, that was a fantastic theory, really. But the police might do that. They might. Her craving for Ben became a frantic need. If only he would come home. Come home and take that body away. Hide it somewhere so the police couldn't connect it with this house. He was strong enough to do it. She crouched there, shaking. It was as if the jaws of a great trap had closed on her. On one side, the storm and the silence of the telephone. And on the other, the presence of the prowler under that still, cramped figure in her trunk. She was caught between them, helpless. As if to accent her helplessness, the wind stepped up its shriek and a tree crashed thunderously out on the road. She heard glass shatter. Her quivering body stiffened like a drawn bow. Was it the prowler attempting to get in? She forced herself to her feet and made a round of the windows. All the glass was intact. Nothing could make her go down into the cellar to see if anything had happened there. The voice of the storm drowned out all but the sound of the clock. Yet she couldn't rid herself of the fancy that she heard footsteps going round and round the house, that eyes sought an opening and spied upon her. A kind of numbness began to come over her, as if her capacity for fear were exhausted. She went back to the chair and curled up in it. 11. Midnight. She huddled there, not moving, not thinking, not even afraid, only numb for another hour. Then the storm held its breath for a moment, and in the brief space of silence, she heard footsteps, firm and quick and loud. A key turned in the lock, the door opened, and Ben came in. He was dripping, dirty, and white with exhaustion, but it was Ben. Once she was sure of it, she flung herself on him, babbling incoherently of what she had found. He kissed her lightly on the cheek and took her arms down from around his neck, and he said, "Here, here, my dear. You get soaked. I'm drenched to the skin. Oh, I had to walk in from the crossroads. What a night." She tried again to tell him of the past hours, but again he cut her short. "No, now, wait a minute, my dear. I can see you're bothered about something, but just wait till I get into some dry things, and then I'll come down and we'll talk things over. Now, suppose you rustle up some coffee and toast." "Oh, I'm done up. The whole trip out was a nightmare. And I didn't know if I'd ever make it from the crossing. No, I've been hours."
Yes, he did look tired, she thought with concern.
Now that he was back, she could wait. The past hours had taken on the quality of a nightmare, horrifying, but curiously unreal. With Ben here so solid and commonplace and cheerful, she began to wonder if the hours were a nightmare. She even began to doubt the reality of the woman in the trunk, although she could see her as vividly as ever. Perhaps only the storm was real. She went to the kitchen and began to make fresh coffee. The chair, still wedged against the kitchen door, was a reminder of her terror. And now that Ben was home, it seemed silly. She put it back in its place by the table.
He came down very soon, before the coffee was ready.
Oh, how good it was to see him in that old gray bathrobe of his hands thrust into its pockets.
She was almost shamefaced when she told him of the face in the window, the open cellar door, and finally of the body in the trunk. None of it, she saw quite clearly now, could possibly have happened. Ben said so, without hesitation. But he came to put an arm around her. He said,
"What the hell now? You poor child. The storm has scared you to death, and I don't wonder. It has given you the jitters."
She smiled dubiously. She said, "Yes, I'm almost beginning to think so. Now that you're back, it seems so safe, but you will look in the trunk, Ben. I've got to know. I can see her so plainly. How could I imagine a thing like that?"
"Of course I'll look, if it'll make you feel better. Well, I'll do it now. Then I can have my coffee in peace."
He went to the cellar door and opened it and snapped on the light. Her heart began to pound once more, a deafening roar in her ears. She could not have imagined it. It was incredible that she could have believed for a minute that her mind had played such tricks on her. In another moment, Ben would know it, too. She heard the thud as he threw back the lid of the trunk. She clutched at the back of the chair, waiting for his voice. It came in an instant.
"There's nothing here but a couple of bundles. Come take a look."
Nothing. Her knees were weak as she went down the stairs, down into the cellar again. It was still musty and damp and draped with cobwebs. The light was still dim. It was just as she remembered it, except the wind was whistling through a broken window and rain was spattering in on the bits of shattered glass on the floor. The branch lying across the sill had removed every scrap of glass from the frame and left not a single jagged edge. Ben was standing by the open trunk, waiting for her. His stocky body was a bulwark. He said,
"You see? There's nothing. Just some old clothes of yours, I guess."
She went to stand beside him. Was she losing her mind? Would she now see that crushed figure in there, see the red dress, the smooth, shining knees when Ben could not, and the ring with the diamond between the lion's paws? Her eyes looked almost reluctantly into the trunk. But why, it is empty. There were the neat newspaper-wrapped packages she'd put away so carefully, just as she had left them deep in the bottom of the trunk, and nothing else. Why, she must have imagined the body. She was light with the relief the knowledge brought her. The actual physical danger did not exist and never had existed. Why, the threat of the law hanging over Ben had been based in a dream. And she said, I dreamed it all. I must have. Yet it was so horribly clear, and I wasn't asleep, and I thought, oh, Ben, I thought...
What did you think, my dear?
He stood looking down at her with an immobility that chilled her more than the cold wind that swept in through the broken window. She tried to read his face, but the light from the single bulb was too weak. It left his features shadowed in broad, dark planes that made him look like a stranger and somehow sinister. And she said,
What was it you thought?
She backed away from him. He moved then. It was only to take his hands from his pockets to stretch his arms toward her, but she stood there for an instant staring at the thing that left her stricken with a voiceless scream forming in her throat. She was never to know whether his arms had been outstretched to take her within their shelter or to clutch at her white neck, for she turned and fled, stumbling up the stairs in a mad panic of escape. He shouted,
"Janet! Janet!"
His steps were heavy behind her. He tripped on the bottom step and fell on one knee and cursed. Terror lent her strength and speed. She could not be mistaken. Although she had seen it only once, she knew that on the little finger of his left hand, there had been the same, the unmistakable ring the dead woman had worn. Oh, the blessed wind snatched the front door from her and flung it wide, and she was out in the safe, dark shelter of the storm.
is Nelson Olmsted. The story you heard tonight was written by a woman and was about a woman. In the moments that remain tonight, and while you're in such a wonderful, sleepless mood, I'd like you to hear the famous poem Edgar Allan Poe wrote about a woman, his wife. Here is Annabel Lee. It was many and many a year ago in a kingdom by the sea that a maiden there lived whom you may know by the name of Annabel Lee. And this maiden she lived with no other thought than to love and be loved by me. I was a child, and she was a child in this kingdom by the sea. But we loved with a love that was more than love, I and my Annabel Lee, with a love the winged seraphs of heaven coveted her and me. And this was the reason that long ago, in this kingdom by the sea, a wind blew out of a cloud, chilling my beautiful Annabel Lee, so that her high-born kinsmen came and bore her away from me, to shut her up in a sepulcher in this kingdom by the sea. The angels, not half so happy in heaven, went envying her and me. Yes, this was the reason, as all men know in this kingdom by the sea, that the wind came out of the cloud by night, chilling and killing my Annabel Lee. But our love, it was stronger by far than the love of those who were older than we, of many far wiser than we. And neither the angels in heaven above nor the demons down under the sea can ever dissever my soul from the soul of the beautiful Annabel Lee. For the moon never beams without bringing me dreams of the beautiful Annabel Lee. And the stars never rise, but I see the bright eyes of the beautiful Annabel Lee. And so, all the night tide, I lie down by the side of my darling, my life and my bride, in her sepulcher there by the sea. In her tomb by the side of the sea.
I know. I didn't mention Annabel Lee. I thought I'd leave it in there as a surprise. Segment 3. Well, yeah, this is it. This is segment 3. We're at the top of segment 3. And generally, I do a science fiction show here. This is going to be no different. This week, it's from Escape. And it's a story called The Adaptive Ultimate, which was based on a Stanley G. Weinbaum story from 1935. You may not know the name Weinbaum, because he only published a couple of dozen stories over a period of 18 months before he died from cancer. His most famous story you may have heard of, it's called A Martian Odyssey. In any case, this is the story of a scientist who invents a serum that allows humans to adapt to any condition and uses it on a dying woman. This turns out not to have been a great idea because she's now able to adapt to anything and becomes more and more powerful. I know this sounds familiar. It's been done in everything from The Twilight Zone to Star Trek. But this is a pretty effective rendition of it. It aired on Escape on March the 26th of 1949. The only thing I have left to announce right now is another break.
Tired
tired of the everyday routine? Ever dream of a life of romantic adventure? Want to get away from it all?
We offer you Escape. Escape, transcribed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
You are standing outside a room, horror gripping you. While before your eyes, seen through the transom window, the most beautiful girl in the world is about to die because of you.
Today we escape from reality with a fascinating story of a girl who lived a weird second life, as John Jessel told it in his gripping story, The Adaptive Ultimate.
No, Daniel, I can't do it. You have a very interesting theory,
but... It's more than a theory, Dr. Bach. I've proved it. It works. I tried my serum on tubercular guinea pigs, and it cured them. They adapted themselves to the tubercular bacillus and live. I tried my serum on a dog with rabies. He adapted himself, too. I tried it on a cat with a broken spine. The cat instantly adapted itself to its injury so that the spine had time to knit and heal. Don't you see what a tremendous discovery this is?
Yes, perhaps.
Well, think what that would mean in accident cases. There'd be no further need for emergency surgery. Don't you see that? No matter what the condition, the injury to the body, a mere injection of my serum would permit the patient instantly to adapt himself to his condition and live.
No matter what his injury.
Exactly.
A serum made from insects.
From a common fruit fly, the most adaptable of living organisms. Tear off a wing and it grows a new one. Tear off its head, even. Stick on a new head, and that, too, will adhere in time. Think of imparting that same adaptability to human beings.
To grow new heads, it has merit.
Oh, now, please, Dr. Bach.
All right, all right. No, seriously. I know this may be a great thing, but to permit you to experiment on a human being, no,
the most hopeless case you can find, Dr. Bach. Someone already doomed.
Well, if someday I discover in the hospital a hopeless case, understand, it will be hopeless.
I understand.
And if the patient shall consent, then you will have your human guinea pig. Well, Dr. Scott, you requisitioned for yourself a hopeless case. Permit me. Here is your guinea pig.
What is it, Dr. Bach? TB?
Yeah, final stage. A matter of hours at most. She might have been attractive once, but now, hair like string, skinny like a skeleton, and flesh like wax.
Dr. Bach, you call this a fair test? I said hopeless, but I didn't say a corpse.
The lady is returning to life, such as it is. Well, Dr. Scott, I regret I have not a more palatable subject for your experiment, but this is what I promised, a hopeless case.
It's all right, I'll try it. Oh, what's her name?
Let me see. It's on the chart here. Zelas.
What was that?
Her name is Kira Zelas.
Oh.
Young lady. Permit me. I am Dr. Hermann Bach, chief of the staff, and I would like to introduce one of our promising young doctors.
He wants a date, I suppose.
Miss Zelas.
Hello, brown eyes.
What?
Your eyes are... brown, aren't they?
Miss Zelas, you see, I've perfected a serum.
I like brown eyes.
This serum might help you, but it has never been tried on a human being before. I thought if you have no objection...
What are the odds?
Odds? Well, actually, you've everything to gain.
And nothing to lose.
Well?
How right you are. Okay. I'm all yours, brown eyes. Go ahead. Experiment away.
Dr. Bach, prepare her arm.
Hours and she is yet alive. I would have said yesterday it would be impossible she should survive the night.
Mm-hmm.
So it is now 48 hours, and she actually seems better. But miracles such as this have happened before, and without serums. A week, and she still lives. Each day she becomes better. It is miraculous. The spots on her lungs are disappearing. Her coughing is stopped. There is no sign of bacillus in the culture. But even more amazing, a reaction to abrasions, skin punctures. Yesterday I took a blood specimen. Before I had 1 cc, the puncture in her skin had closed. Yes, in 30 seconds. The ordinary person, it takes a day, 2 days for it to heal. With Miss Kira Zelas, 30 seconds. It is amazing. Then I will not dispute it. Your serum has worked a miracle. She is cured. And now I must just discharge her from the hospital.
But, well, Dr. Bach,
I... You had forgotten that time must come sometime, hmm? But you see, I must. She is cured, and we need the room.
Well, yes. Yes, I know, but... Well, she should be under observation. We don't know what effects will show up.
I think, Daniel, you have an extraordinary interest in Miss Zelas. So, I have asked her to come here. She is outside. Shall we invite her in?
Why, yes, of course.
Send in Miss Zelas, please. Now, observe well your miracle. Miss Zelas, come in, come in. Sit down.
Thanks. Oh, hello, Brown Eyes.
Hello, Kira.
I have sent for you, Miss Zelas, because I have good news. Today I am discharging you from the hospital.
Oh?
Yeah? Today you are free to go. That pleases you?
Madly.
Kira, you have people, perhaps? A family?
Aren't we all brothers and sisters under the skin?
Miss Zelas, I will come to the point. I wish to make you a proposition. I mean purely a scientific...
Yes, I know. An experiment.
Precisely. We are interested, Dr. Scott and I, to observe the further effects of the serum he gave you.
Yes?
I will pay you board and room and $30 a week. You will live at my house. I have a housekeeper, Mrs. Getz. She will look after you. Is that satisfactory?
Wouldn't I be a fool to say no?
Excellent, excellent.
Does Brown Eyes live there, too?
No, but Dr. Scott will continue to have a clinical interest in the experiment. Miss Zelas, have no fear.
Good.
Yes. Well, it is now almost time for dinner. I will take you, Miss Zelas. You will join us, Dr. Scott?
Why, yes, fine, Dr. Bach.
Very well. We shall meet outside in, what, 10 minutes?
That'll do me nicely.
Miss Zelas, you wish to wait here or maybe outside? A little fresh air?
I think I could use a little air.
Good. There is a little park across the street. You will find benches there to rest. We will meet at the front entrance in 10 minutes.
Dr. Bach, what is it? What's the matter?
Some sort of commotion across the street in the park. Oh. Where is Kira?
Well, I thought she'd be here with you.
Perhaps she is still over there in the park.
What do you suppose? Come on! Dr. Bach, it is Kira. Kira, let me through, please. Kira, let us through, please. Officer, what's happened? What is this? Why are you holding this lady?
You know this woman?
Yes, of course. What is it? What's the matter here?
Plenty. Your lady friend here merely walks up to an old gent about 60 or so, picks up a nice hefty rock, and beats his brains out.
Officer, there must be some awful mistake.
Yeah, her mistake. Cold-blooded murder. Come on, sister. There's the wagon.
But, officer, listen...
You'd better come along, too, mister. Mona Lisa here don't seem to be much in the mood for talking. We'll need someone to tell the desk sergeant her name.
Kira, this is terrible, seeing you here like this. I've got to get you out of here. I've got to help you.
She is not so bad when you're here.
Well, listen, this is all a terrible mistake. If you'll tell me what...
Mistake?
Why, yes, of course. Kira, you didn't kill that man.
If I said yes, what would you do?
Why, I'd tell him you weren't responsible. I'd tell him about the serum. I'd tell him it was my fault that somehow the serum I gave you caused your mind to snap something. That would be the only explanation.
You'd do this? Ruin your career, no doubt? Just to save me?
Well, yes, of course I would.
And what would they do to me?
I don't know exactly. Put you away under observation? Something? Kira,
then my answer's no. I did not kill the man. Oh, don't worry. I won't be convicted. I'll take care of myself very well. I'll, as you say, adapt myself to the situation.
All right now, Mr. Salvatore, continue. Tell the court in your own words precisely what happened.
This old man, you see, is buying circus peanuts from me every day. For months, every day. And this one day, he pull out his pocketbook, his billfold, and I'm look, it's stuffed with the bills. The big money. He says, Salvatore, can I make a change for $20? And I'm laugh. I'm say, mister, I'm a peanut man. You take the peanuts and you pay me tomorrow. He said, thank you very much. He turn around, and then here's this dame, she pick up was a great big stone and a conks him. It's murder.
I object, Your Honor.
Objection sustained.
Continue, Mr. Salvatore.
Oh, she nothing more to say. This dame, she bend over and she reach in his pocket to take the money. I'm a grabber, people come, police come and
Mr. Salvatore, can you describe this young lady to us?
Oh, see, I remember her very well. She's skinny. She's ain't no beauty, you know. You got the black suit, the brown hair, eyes, don't know, dark, you know, maybe brown or blue.
Thank you, Mr. Salvatore. Your witness.
Mr. Salvatore, you say that the young lady, the assailant, had brown hair and dark eyes?
Si. Brown hair, dark blue eyes.
And do you see the young lady in the courtroom?
Oh, si. She's a sit right to...
What's the matter, Mr. Salvatore? Huh? Are you pointing at Mrs. Ailes?
See?
May I ask the defendant to rise, please? Mrs. Ailes, will you kindly remove your hat, please?
Dr. Bach, look. Her hair, it's become the color of aluminum.
Your Honor, I submit that this defendant does not possess dark hair, nor, if you will observe, dark eyes. I am prepared, therefore, to submit a lock of her hair to be tested by any chemist the court may appoint to prove that the pigmentation is entirely natural. Oh, I don't believe that it is. It can't be. Now, Mr. Salvatore, do you still say that this is the young lady you saw in the park?
I think she's...
Is she?
Mamma mia, she... No!
Good Lord, Dr. Bach, that hair of hers. Did you see it? It was the color of aluminum. She was beautiful.
Yeah, beautiful. And so she has been acquitted. They call her innocent. Daniel, I am a convert to your great principle of adaptability. But where will it end? You start with an ideal, and you wake up to discover you have created a monster.
But she was acquitted. It was all a mistake.
You really believe that?
Dr. Bach.
Yes, Mrs. Griss?
She is healed, doctor.
She?
That woman in the newspaper.
Ah. Kira is here?
You said she was so poor, such a church mouse. Ah, you should see her.
What do you mean, Mrs. Griss?
So fine, so great a lady.
I'll go and talk to her, Dr. Bach.
Hello, Brown Eyes.
Hello, Kira.
Aren't you glad to see me?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. Oh, congratulations on your acquittal today. We were there.
I know. I sensed it. I was hurt that you didn't come up and congratulate me.
Well, there were photographers and what... Why, Kira, your hair, it's black again.
Isn't it always? Don't you like it?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. It's beautiful.
Am I beautiful? Brown eyes.
Very, very beautiful.
And are you happy to have me back? I always did like brown eyes.
Kira.
Tell me, how do you like my new clothes? My gown?
Why, it's very nice.
Nice? It's exquisite. I have a whole new wardrobe, hat, shoes.
Well, how, Kira? Where did you get the money?
Money?
You only had $3 when you left the hospital.
Oh, so I did.
Kira. Kira, you did take that wallet from the old man.
Why, naturally.
You did murder him.
Certainly. Oh, come, don't look so shocked. Oh, I'm tired, Brown Eyes. You'll excuse me if I appropriate Dr. Bach's room. Good night.
Dr. Bach, we've got to do something.
Yes, Daniel, we do.
I haven't slept a wink all night trying to think of what we can do.
I've been here in the laboratory all night. I think I know.
What?
This serum of yours, it has accomplished a miracle, yeah. It is the adaptive ultimate. Changes that take the ordinary person days or months, she accomplishes instantly. She walks into the sunlight, she is tan. She walks out, she is pale again. When she is in danger, she adapts. She could survive the electric chair, the hangman's noose. She was in danger in the courtroom. She adapted. She changed her whole appearance at will, so she could not be identified.
Yes, I know, I know.
Oh, you must not blame yourself. You could not know what you were creating. Now, this morning, I operated on one of your guinea pigs. I found this. The pineal gland hypertrophied. That is what causes it.
Well, then we could operate and... and maybe change her back.
Yeah, but she can adapt to anything, anesthesia included. How can we operate? Unless we get her consent.
Well, perhaps.
Oh, you are dreaming, Daniel. Do you really think she will consent now? Now that she has power? Perhaps more power than any human being ever possessed before. Power for evil. And she has already killed one man, remember.
But if we watched her, Doctor, kept her under guard...
Again Pygmalion falls in love with his Galatea. No, Daniel, no. She must be destroyed. We must perform surgery at once.
Well, she'll die.
She will go back to what she was, with but a few hours to live. It is best, Daniel.
Yes, I suppose so.
Yes? Yes, Mrs. Goetz? Danke.
What is it, Dr. Bach?
And so perhaps she is also telepathic. She sensed what we were about to do, and now it is too late.
What do you mean?
Miss Zelas is gone. Disappeared.
Dr. Bach, did you call for me?
Yeah, Daniel. Have you seen the evening paper yet?
No, not yet.
Then here. After 2 months, there is news of our Miss Kira Zelas.
What? Let me see there. Where? Oh. The surprise of the evening was the appearance of John Kellen, ambassador at large, diplomat extraordinary, the man slated to head the forthcoming World Atomic Energy Control Commission. Mr. Kellen, one of Washington's confirmed bachelors, squired the gorgeous Kira Zelas.
You see? She has become gorgeous, our drab little urchin.
Miss Zelas, the dazzling beauty who affects a dark wig by day and a white one at night.
A great power of adaptability, courtesy of Dr. Daniel Scott. Dark by day, white by night.
Well, what are we going to do, Doctor?
Do?
The World Atomic Energy Control, the one real hope of world peace. Curie isn't interested in peace.
What can we do? Surgery, I know. But politics? We must wait and see. We must wait and see how far your mad woman will go.
Washington is agog with rumors about the romance between glamorous Kira Zelas and John Kellen, the newly appointed head of the World Atomic Energy Control, one of the most powerful political figures on the globe.
John Kellen leaves tomorrow for the crucial atomic energy conferences at Geneva, Switzerland, and sailing on the same boat as the exotic Miss Kira Zelas, with whom his name has been frequently linked. Rumor has it Miss Zelas acts as a sort of unofficial assistant to Mr. Kellen, thus making her one of the most important women in the world.
Glamorous, exotic. Of such fragile stuff is world peace fashioned these days, Daniel.
I wonder what she intends to...
Somebody calling at dinner time?
Oh, sit still, Dr. Bach. I'll see who it is. Yes? Kira!
Hello, Brown Eyes. May I come in?
Why, yes, of course.
Oh-ho! Our exotic guinea pig, hmm?
Good evening, Dr. Bach. I'm not intruding.
Of course not.
You're very kind. John and I, You've read about Mr. Callan?
Oh, yes, yes.
We're leaving for Europe tomorrow for the conferences in Switzerland.
Yes.
He had a series of meetings to attend tonight, so I told him I would stay here.
You're staying here?
I took the liberty of saying you were my uncle, Dr. Buck.
Oh.
John will call for me in the morning on his way to the airport. We're leaving at 8. I do hope I'm not too late for dinner.
Not at all. In fact, we're very happy to have you here, aren't we, Dr. Scott?
Kira.
Hello, Brown Eyes.
What are you doing out here in the garden?
Waiting for you.
You knew I'd follow you?
Of course. Have you missed me?
You know I have. Oh, Kira, listen to me. Do you love this John Callan?
When I want love, I'll come to you, Brown Eyes.
Well, then why? What is it, money?
Money? I don't need money anymore. What does an empress need with money?
Empress?
That's what you've made me. The most powerful woman the world's ever known. John Callan. He's supposed to be important. But in my hands, he's clay, to be molded as I wish. Do you see what that means?
Yes, I see. You hold the fate of the world in your hands.
Exactly. To do with as I want. And I shall. Would you like to rule the world with me, Brown Eyes?
Kira, you're evil.
What is good? What's evil? Come here, Brown Eyes. Look at me. And forget such things.
Are you asleep, Dr. Buck?
Sleep? Who can sleep?
Kira's insane, Doctor. Do you know what she's planning to do?
I heard.
Oh. Maybe we could get to this Callan.
And then what?
Well, if we could talk to him, tell him...
Tell him what? Didn't I talk to you? Would you listen? Where is she?
Oh, she's gone to sleep.
I tell you, there's only one remedy, surgery. It is the only hope.
But she'll never consent to surgery, Dr. Bach, and she's probably immune to anesthesia.
Maybe not. Maybe not all anesthesia.
What?
Downstairs in my laboratory, I have a tank of ethyl chloride.
You mean operate here tonight?
Yeah, tonight. Right here, where she sleeps. All right, then. Now stop staring down at her. Pour the anesthesia onto the cone. Hurry.
That ought to be enough to anesthetize an elephant.
Onto the face, quickly.
All right.
Then, tightly, hold it
I'm
close.
I'm trying! She's forcing my hands. I can't hold her. She's too strong.
Fools! Did you think you could make me unconscious? You were going to operate on me. Is that what you were planning? Or were you going to slit my throat with that scalpel? Look.
Kira, don't!
There. You see? I plunge your knife into my heart. I withdraw it. And the wound is healed. Now, go away, both of you. I want to sleep. John will be calling for me at 8.
In the morning. 2.5 hours more and she will leave. And the world will be one step nearer chaos. We are scientists, Dan. We have a responsibility to civilization. We must find a way to destroy this...
Carbon dioxide.
Carbon dioxide,
it's a fundamental biological law. No human can survive in its own waste product. Carbon dioxide is a human waste. Dr. Bach, if we could fill the room where she's sleeping with carbon dioxide, she'd become unconscious. You could operate, then. Who are you calling?
The hospital. I will have them send over 2 tanks of carbon dioxide.
You think it should work, then?
We must try anything. Hello, this is Dr. Bach. Let me talk to surgery. Now hurry, it is an emergency. Is ready. You sealed the crack under the door?
Yes.
You closed the window?
Yes.
All right. Let us start the gas. Well, then, through the transom above the bedroom door,
You will be able to observe her reactions.
You placed the lighted candle inside the room?
Yes, Doctor. I left the candle on the table.
Observe it carefully.
All right.
When it goes out, your Miss Kira Zelas should be unconscious. Ben, can you see inside the room from up there?
Yes, Doctor. Candle is flickering, Doctor. Wait. No, it's still flickering. It's just gone out, Doctor.
Excellent. It means there is now a concentration of 8 or 10% carbon dioxide. The average person would long since be dead.
Doctor.
Yeah, Dan, what?
Oh, just a minute.
Yes, yes.
She's breathing much more quickly now, convulsively.
Jane stopped breathing.
She's opening her eyes now.
What?
She's getting up.
Getting up?
She's staggering. Holding her throat, Doctor. She's gasping. She's moving toward the door. She's trying to unlock the...
So.
She's seen me. She's trying to...
Well, what is it?
She's collapsed. It's over.
Yes?
How do you do, Dr. Bach? I'm John Callan.
Yes, of course. Come in.
I haven't taken you away from anything.
Oh, no. We were performing some surgery, my associate and I. I have a miniature surgery here for emergencies, and we have just finished.
Is that the patient on the table?
Yes.
Is she...
Yes, she is dead.
Too bad. Silly-looking creature, wasn't she?
She was a charity case.
Well, I won't keep you. Is Kira here?
No, she changed her plans. She said there were some things she wished to do, and she would meet you at the airport.
Well, that's a woman's prerogative, isn't it, changing plans?
Yes.
I'd better get a move on, then. Nice to see you, Doctor. I hope we'll meet again when I return from Europe.
Yes, that will be nice, Mr. Callan, and good luck on your mission.
Thank you, sir. Goodbye.
Yeah, goodbye. Well, Daniel, maybe we will get some sleep now. Dan.
Huh? Oh, I'm sorry, Doctor. I was daydreaming. She's lovely, isn't she?
Lovely? Yeah, then lovely. May she always be in your memory.
Escape is produced and directed by Norman MacDonald. Today, we have presented transcribed The Adaptive Ultimate by John Jessel, adapted for radio by Chet Spurgeon and Herb Futran, with editorial supervision by John Dunkel, starring Edgar Berrier as Dr. Bach and Stacey Harris as Dan Scott. Featured in the cast were Elsie Holmes, Frank Gerstle, Larry Dobkin, Tom Charlesworth, and Ann Morrison. Special music was arranged and played by Ivan Dittmars. Next week...
You are trapped in a dark, empty house. A girl lying dead at your feet. And surrounding you, closing in on you, are the band of killers, deadly enemies of your country and yourself. And they are intent on murdering you.
Next week, we escape with the famous story, Confidential Agent, by Graham Greene. Be sure to tune in at this same time next week, when once again we offer you Escape. This is Roy Rowan speaking for CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Okay, one more break here, but we'll be right back with Do Not Disturb the Dead. Sounds like good advice to me. Before we get into Do Not Disturb the Dead, I want to quickly explain that Do Not Disturb the Dead was part of a series that ran in 1935 called The Origins of Superstition. The Origin of Superstition attempted to throw some light on, through dramatic reenactment, well, the origin of superstition. I know that's getting a bit repetitive. But it will try to explain why some people are afraid of the boogeyman, and why some people carry a rabbit's foot, why your grandfather doesn't open an umbrella in the house, why do some people think four-leaf clovers are lucky, and why a shooting star? I mean, it's just a rock falling out of the sky. Well, we know that now, but they didn't always know that. And this is an interesting series that tries to explain how these things came into currency. It's a 15-minute series, so we won't be spending a lot of time with it. And immediately after that is Incredible But True, which ran in 1951 and bears a good deal of similarity to Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Superstition. Demand a worship from poor and rich alike, from the weak and from the strong. My victims are many. My slaves are legion. You who scoff and disbelieve, listen to this story.
Come to order. This is a session extraordinary of the Supreme Court, held this day of our Lord at the grave of the late deceased Henry Byron at Calvary Cemetery. You will come to order. Justice Peck, presiding.
The petition before the court states that the disinherited son of the late Henry Byron would exhume the body of his father. Mr. Byron, you may state your reason.
My belief that my father never signed the will that disinherited me. The thumbprint alongside the signature on the will is not his.
As your sister and the daughter of the deceased, I protest. The thumbprint on the will was that of my father. I saw him accidentally spill the ink that caused the print.
Your Honor, there is $100,000 at stake. The body must be disinterred. The fingerprint taken. There should be no doubt existing.
I still object. Disaster will follow if my father's body is disturbed.
My sister is gripped in the throes of a violent superstition, a throwback from the Dark Ages.
Call it what you will. Thou shalt not disturb the dead.
Rubbish. Superstition. My claim is just. Let the grave diggers proceed. It's beginning to rain.
Yes, it rains. Tears from heaven. Perhaps a benediction on the dead.
Superstition.
A protest from the gods.
Judge, may I request, give the order for exhumation.
Wait.
I'll gladly give up the money. Please do not disturb the body.
It's not the money, it's vindication. He never intended to disinherit me. Let the earth be removed.
My son, perhaps your sister is right. Death may stalk in the wake of the disturbed dead.
Again, I say, superstition. Surely the Supreme Court is above such distorted belief.
You're impulsive, impetuous, inviting enterprises that involve danger and daring. Before I give my decision, let me take you back to the career of a young man, Lord Cameron, who challenged the power of death, ignored the superstition involved with the opening of the tomb of an Egyptian king. He paid with his life.
I remember the case, Your Honor. You were a member of the party, I believe.
Yes. It was at Luxor, Egypt. Lord Cameron had been warned by many not to attempt the opening of the tomb. It seems as yesterday. I can hear him now as he laughed at all our advice.
My dear friend Peck, it is absurd to ask me to give up this venture.
But you are practically violating the dead, Lord Cameron.
I am contributing to science, unveiling the mystery of the ages.
It is written, thou shalt not disturb the dead.
Superstition. Let the caravan proceed. Camel boy, advance.
Aye, aye, aye.
You will rue it. Now mark my word.
Are you coming along? Will you brave the death you predict for me?
I suppose so. But may the Lord attend us.
Look. The workers have removed the earth from the main door leading to the tomb. Let's hurry.
Hi! Hi!
Your explorative and adventurous nature leads to your death?
Stop sounding the funeral knell. There's work to be done. Ah, here we are. Hassan, my faithful, the workers have not been idle.
The entrance way has been cleared. There is nothing left to do but toss the sealed stone.
It's not too late, Lord Cameron. Let us be content to decipher the hieroglyphics on the terrace of the tomb. Let the dead rest.
What? Stop now? On the threshold of amazing discoveries? You must be mad. Give me that hammer.
Yes, sire.
Dig. Dig, Hassan. Close to the base of the stone.
Great Scott! The slab is yielding.
Soon we will know the secrets of the empire that ruled this entire continent.
There. The slab door is removed, my lord.
The tomb is open. The tomb is open. Success.
Marvelous. That will make you famous, my lord.
Come, let us enter. Hassan, Houdi, come.
My lord, I cannot go in. I am afraid. It is dark. I am afraid.
Afraid? Afraid of what? The dead? Fear the living, not the dead. Come!
He is trembling, poor fellow. He fears not the dead, but the blasphemous act of desecration.
Superstition. Silly rubbish. Come, Hammoudi. Hand me the trowel. I'll go in alone.
I'll proceed. I'll follow.
Bring the light. Ah, that's better. Don't touch a thing. It may crumble to dust. Judge, here lies before you the history of 4,000 years.
What is that other room?
Leading to the main tomb of the king. I want to open that door.
It's covered with inscriptions. How do you intend to get those writings out of here?
We use wet blotting paper laid on the stone, beaten in gently with a small wooden hammer, then lifted carefully off and dried.
You decipher them here?
No. I'll ship them back to Britain to be deciphered while I continue the field work. Stand back, Judge. The door is opening.
For the last time, I ask you to desist. Why risk your life to stuff the British Museum with relics?
I'm going in the tomb and defy the superstitions.
A storm threatens. The gods are angry. Come away, my lord.
Or I'm leaving. I'll wait outside.
Coward! I am determined to gaze upon the wonders of the past.
I am sorry for my master.
No good will come of this.
Hassan! Hammoudi! Judge Peck!
I have seen.
You're trembling, my lord. What have you seen, my lord? How pale you are, Lord Cameron.
I have seen the mummified body of the king. Jewels, golden chariots, magnificent images studded with precious stones, pagan gods inlaid with lapis lazuli.
There. You're ill, my lord, burning with fever. What has happened, my lord?
Oh, something I inhaled as I entered the tomb. It fairly choked me. I'll be all right. Hassan.
Yes, my lord.
Close the tomb. Leave a guard. Hammoudi.
Yes, my lord.
Remain outside here until the British consul arrives. Judge Peck, help me. I am weak. Take me back to the hotel.
Come. Camel boy! Aye, aye!
My chest is tightening. Help me, Judge.
You're very ill, my lord.
Oh, stay with me, Judge. Take me back to England. I want to see my family. Something tells me I am very ill. Take me back to England.
There, my lord. Safe on board ship, you'll soon be home.
Home. It is such a sweet word. Where is the music playing?
In the dining salon. Too bad that you're too weak to go to dinner.
I am weak, old friend. Slowly sinking.
I warned you not to defy the superstitions.
Gladly I give my life. If I have made history.
You're too young to die, even though you contribute to science.
When I tore the wrapped shroud from the mummified king, a hot breath of gas came from it. I must have inhaled it.
Perhaps medical science will restore you.
I'm afraid not, old friend. I'm afraid not. I remember now, right above the tomb door, was a plaque. Words in ancient hieroglyphics. Words which I have heard you speak, my friend.
Words that I have spoken? What were they?
Prophetic words. Words of truth. Thou shalt not disturb the dead.
And Lord Cameron died in my arms.
A victim of his own rashness, his defiance.
And now, Mr. Byron, has my story impressed you? Do you still persist in disturbing the dead?
Let the dead rest in peace. I withdraw the action.
Bless you, brother. The money shall be yours. The dead be undisturbed, and peace of mind be ours.
But, Judge, tell me. How come the superstition concerning the raising of the dead?
It was known long before the pagan Greeks placed their dead in caskets, before savages hung their dead in trees, before India hurled their bodies into the Ganges River, long before Egypt mummified their departed ones. It came from the lips of the Creator of you and I and all things. He said, thou shalt not disturb the dead.
I am superstition. Do you believe?
Thank you.
ages, in all cultures, in all countries, the belief has persisted that certain men are able to transform themselves into wild animals, into werewolves and were-tigers, that they prey upon domesticated stock and even upon other human beings. Lycanthropy, the scientists call this phenomena, and the mere fact that it has acquired a technical name would suggest that it is based on something more than primitive fantasy. But there is even better evidence than this. Witness, for example, the strange affair of Captain Choate and the elusive hyena.
He was a hunter and an adventurer, this Captain Choate of the Order of Distinguished Service. Himself, in October of 1918, sitting in a hut in a village of far-off Nigeria. Nor, since he was known and trusted by the natives there, is it surprising that their leader should confide in him the misfortunes that were afflicting the village.
Raiding hyenas, eh?
Yes, Captain. Or perhaps one hyena. He steals among us at night. He destroys everything. He has the body of an animal, but the brain of a man.
What?
You see, Captain, he is a man. At night, he transforms himself into a hyena. We know. We have followed his tracks, and always they lead to the next village, and always... just before they reach the village, they turn into human tracks.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm sure they do. Well, whatever he is, my friend, tonight we're going to get him.
That night, in the company of the tribal leader, Captain Choate set out to hunt down the hyena. When the two men reached the outskirts of the village, a bright moon was shining. They made their way cautiously through the treacherous swampland. For more than an hour, they walked thus, their every sense alert. And then suddenly...
Look, there he is. Lord, what a brute.
Some distance away, an enormous hyena was slinking furtively across a clearing, his great hulking form silhouetted in the moonlight. Captain Choate took careful aim.
Stop him! Come along, hurry!
The two men rushed toward the clearing, but when they reached it... the hyena was gone.
Oh, I could have sworn I hit him squarely in the head.
There is blood on the ground here.
What's that lying in the middle there? Why, it looks like a... By George, it is, a jawbone. Come along, let's follow his tracks.
An easy trail to follow, for it was marked at regular intervals by great splotches of blood. It led directly to the neighboring village, and then it stopped abruptly. Exhausted and disappointed... they accepted the invitation of an aged villager to spend the night in his hut. When they awoke at sunrise, their host had vanished. He returned a few moments later in a state of great agitation.
What has happened, my friend?
It is Bano. Bano is dead. He was my neighbor. He was wise man and mighty hunter.
The gods have cursed him with a sickness, eh?
No. He was not sick. He was killed with gun. Someone fired it in his face. His jawbone was shot away.
After that, the monstrous hyena never again was seen near the village. Nor did anyone ever learn the identity of the man who had killed the native Bano. That the animal and the man should have been one and the same creature is, of course, inconceivable. But what other explanation is there for this baffling story? A story incredible, but true.
Okay, that's the end of the old radio shows. We've got about 10 minutes left. And we'll spend those few minutes listening to music. Stuff I hope you like. I'm trying to find stuff that you've either never heard before or haven't heard in a long time. I hope I'm successful. Anyway, I'll be here next week, and I hope you will, too. Now comes the part that I know you've been waiting for. The part where I shut up and go home.
You talk like Marlene Dietrich, and you dance like Zizi Jarmer. Your clothes are all made by Balmain, and there's diamonds and pearls in your hair. Yes, there are. you live in a fancy apartment off the boulevard Saint-Michel, where you keep your Rolling Stones records and a friend of Sacha Distel? Yes, you do. But where do you go to, my lovely, when you're alone in your bed? Tell me the thoughts that surround you. I want to look inside your head, yes, I do. I've seen all your qualifications you got from the Sorbonne, and the painting you stole from Picasso. Your loveliness goes on and on, yes, it does. When you go on your summer vacation, you go to Juan-les-Pins with your carefully designed topless swimsuit. You get an even suntan on your back and on your legs, and when the snow falls, you're found in Samoritz with the others of the jet set, and you sip your Napoleon brandy, but you never get your lips wet. No, you don't. But where do you go to, my lovely, when you're alone in your bed? Won't you tell me the thoughts that surround you? I want to look inside your head, yes, I do. Your name, it is heard in high places. You know the Aga Khan. He sent you a racehorse for Christmas, and you keep it just for fun, for a laugh. They say that when you get married, it'll be to a millionaire, but they don't realize where you came from, and I wonder if they really care or give a damn. Where do you go to, my lovely, when you're alone in your bed? Tell me the thoughts that surround you. I want to look inside your head, yes, I do. I remember the back streets of Naples, two children begging in rags, both touched with a burning ambition to shake off their lowly bone takes. They try. So look into my face, Marie Claire, and remember just who you are. Then go and forget me forever, but I know you still bear the scar deep inside. Yes, you do. I know where you go to, my lovely, when you're alone in your bed. I know the thoughts that surround you, 'cause I can look inside your
thank you. slave to his wandering ways, and the wayward wind is a restless wind, a restless wind. Down. I'm now alone with a broken heart.